We're delighted to have Robin Williams here to present the 2009 Pearce Oration. Many of you, I'm sure everyone here knows Robin from the Science Show, which he's been hosting since 1975. And he's also host of Occam's Razor and In Conversation. All of them are on Radio National. Robin has a science degree from the University of London, but he actually went back to London to get that after migrating to Australia in 1964, where he worked on the Snowy Scheme. If that wasn't enough to scare him off, he went back to London, started a career in television, where he starred in Doctor Who, apparently not as a Dalek, much to my disappointment, and also in Monty Python, where his cameo had a cameo appearance apparently in one episode as an exploding Scotsman. And also somebody who spent time running around the Tate Museum making the statues decent by putting bras and knickers on them. Anyway, he came back to Australia in 1972, walked into a job at the ABC, and has been there ever since. In the meantime, he's written 10 books, three of which have been made their way onto the high school reading list, has numerous honorary degrees, has had two fellowships at Oxford, a Balliol Fellowship and a Reuters Fellowship. He's held significant public offices as the president of the Australian Museum, he was the chair of the Commission for the Future, and so on. He holds adjunct university appointments at the wrong universities, namely the University of New South Wales and the University of Queensland. I think he has very poor taste in that regard. Anyway, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Robin Williams.
Yes, Peter, lovely to see you again. I've called my oration Karaoke Journalism, with the subtext of karaoke technology. The question of what is this technology for? And this afternoon, I attended both sessions, very interesting indeed. At first, I thought the technology was mainly about games and business, vaguely about health, we weren't quite sure how to apply, and vaguely about intelligent buildings and infrastructure. Meanwhile, what I'm going to talk about is media as an example of disruption. But it seemed to me, Peter, what you said about climate change and the way the technology is going to come into its own was absolutely spot on. But let me start with a few headlines. This first one, the news about the internet from the New York Review of Books. Quote, David Simon, a former Baltimore Sun reporter and creator of The Wire, just started on ABC 2, offered a particularly barbed version during recent testimony at the Senate on the future of journalism. While the internet is a marvelous tool, he declared, leeches reporting from mainstream news publications, whereupon aggregated websites and bloggers contribute little more than repetition, commentary, and froth. Meanwhile, readers acquire news from the aggregators and abandon the point of origin, namely the newspapers themselves. In short, and this is the point of what he says, the parasite is slowly killing the host. Another headline, this time from the journal Nature, if you happen to follow science and technology. Just a short paragraph. Science journalism is dying in the mass media. It's always been a niche subject, but only those really interested in it will continue to purchase specialist science media. Print publications will become more niche, but will survive. TV news and documentaries will become dumbed down in order to compete with the idiocy on the internet. I'm simply quoting. I'm from the ABC. I have no opinions. You know this. Next, and my final quotation, just to set things up, is from the monthly magazine published here, and an article by John Birmingham titled Mashup, A Short History of the Media Future. He says, Fairfax's share price collapse is emblematic of a media sector in free fall. For all the public woe of Australia's media giants, though, they are the very picture of health compared with their peers overseas, where the collapse and disintegration of established media businesses is accelerating. Fairfax's reported loss of $380 million last financial year, on top of a rolling series of massive redundancies, might seem less than bragworthy, but the House of Fairfax is cruising compared to, say, the New York Times, whose mountain of debt was reduced to junk status last year. And so on it goes. The collapse of media almost everywhere, the culling of reporters by their thousand, 26,000 of them in the past 2 years in the American media. So that's a brief stroll through some of the headlines in my trade. And what I'm trying to suggest is these things are happening disruptively, but I wonder how many people have thought out in what ways we're going to plan for the succession, for what happens next. Well, I'm actually moved by anniversaries. As you heard from Peter, I've been doing the Science Show for about 35 years, which was a time way back before CDs, ATMs, laptops, AIDS, the internet, Google, or Twittering ever were even thought of. I actually began broadcasting in 1972 while people, and this is so old-fashioned, still walked on the moon. In fact, my first two jobs were covering Apollo 16 and 17, when guys just walked around the moon. We couldn't do that today. In fact, looking to anniversaries, the internet was dreamed up only 20 years ago by Tim Berners-Lee, as you know, and it was demonstrated only 18 years ago, incredibly recently. So while we're sitting around this table thinking about the future, you're talking about, in fact, a teenager in terms of the internet. So we don't know yet its significance. My thesis, which is not of an old Luddite, even though when I began, the pencil was a brand new technology, which I badmouthed, of course. But I'm suggesting that we are too ready to embrace new products and not new ideas, new products, without understanding these products' usefulness, some of which was discussed this afternoon pretty damn well. Secondly, the second part of my thesis is we're too ready to consign good ideas to the knacker's yard before appreciating how useful they can still be. We've become addicted neophiliacs. Why am I wearing these headphones? Had I forgotten, or was it just an affectation? These are very simple things which lots of techos ask me about. What is this new device? In fact, it's about 30 years old. Simply, it's radio. You turn it on, you listen to any radio you like. You dial it. It's very cheap, costs you about $20. Get it from Dick Smith. Just. When I lost it in London, or it was nicked, I went to Tottenham Court Road and went to about 35 different radio stores. They looked at me in astonishment. They'd never heard of anything like that. I said, you've still got radio. You put radio on your head and you walk and you listen to it. They offered me something with 45 knobs that could actually organize the next mission to Mars. But a simple thing like a bike or radio headphones, no way. As you heard, when I was in Oxford, I did a few things, including write a book called Normal Service Won't Be Resumed. And I thought I'd just give you an extract from that to give you a taste of what I thought of in the beginning of 1996, when the internet was unbelievably young. It wasn't even out of nappies. Trying to look to the future to see what our world might be like. Just a brief bit, okay? It's a working day in the year 2020. You're sitting on the very fast train, moving soundlessly at 350 km/h between Melbourne and Sydney. Now that's a technology I would spend $43 billion on. There are three things you could do now to occupy the couple of hours of the journey. You can't decide which one to do at the moment, but you take out your Hypertel in preparation. The Hypertel, developed by CSIRO and AWA in 2010, to suit Australian conditions, is the size of a small mobile phone, but it lets you do far more than just call the office. This one has an extendable screen the size of a laptop, and you can pull it out as smoothly as an aerial on a radio. On it, you can dial up almost anything, any page of any book in an Australian library, a map telling you where you are and how to get somewhere, a film or a video presentation, even a virtual image of your local hypermarket where you can stroll virtually and select items from the shelves to be delivered before you reach home. Your three choices are in complete contrast, and you'll select one of them depending on your mood. First, you could dial up the latest David Attenborough series. Yes, he's still at it, though 95 and looking like a teenage turtle in his green safari suit. Unable now to dangle from rainforest trees in Madagascar, because there are none left, he has this time investigated the wild things in your alimentary canal and vascular systems. A robotic nano crew has rafted into a volunteer's guts to film the population there. Zillions of creatures. Did you know that you carry more microorganisms than cells? Does this mean you're still a person or just a great big walking bag of germs? The Attenborough series Life on You is released this week. You could watch the scheduled screening later at home, but most people don't bother. They see what's new from a menu of programs released daily and can dial up what they desire, free of the old-fashioned tyranny of broadcast time. Some of us have the home computer well accustomed to our taste. It automatically scans the daily offerings and lines up a selection of what we like before we return home each day. But you want something different right now. You glance out of the window of the flying train to avoid the chastening sight of other passengers, most of them at workstations, toiling over memoranda and spreadsheets. This was written in 1996. Your second choice is a bit more like work. It's a dissertation by the new Prime Minister, Senator Conroy, on the rationing of air. His book is in the form of a radio or an audio or a book as such, and you could take what looks like a medium-sized book from your case and plug it into your Hypertel. The book isn't really ordinary. Its fine, paper-like pages are of a delicate plastic-like material, and they're all blank. The cover is soft but strong, and for those who really like books, there is even a musty, woody smell, like a book, to make you feel comfortable. So if you dial up Stephen Conroy's dissertation, it will immediately flow from your Hypertel to the pages of your book with coloured illustrations and the odd CD-ROM type of moving picture. Then you can read it like any paperback and even make marginal notes and underline text. Your marks can be wiped clean by pushing a clear button. Anything you want to keep can be printed off at your office in Adelaide at the flick of a switch. Doesn't it seem wonderfully old-fashioned? All of it, practically, is with us now. And that's what's quite extraordinary. But what I was thinking of then is a kind of social implication of what we want this stuff for. I was trying to imagine, first of all, a train. You're on a train going very quickly, not on a plane. And you're using the time in a particular way. And you understand why you want to use that. And I was inspired by the thesis of somebody called Professor Peter Hall, who was in fact a geographer, who suggested that every 50 years, since about 160 years ago, but the book was written about 13 years ago, you had transport revolutionizing how we live with communication systems operating in tandem. So then, 150 years ago, you had trains. At the same time, you had photography, the electric telegraph, because you had to say what the timetable was or when the train was coming, the penny post and Pitman's shorthand, all in a bunch together. 100 years ago, at the turn of the century before last, in other words, about 1900, you had planes and cars. The typewriter, the phonograph, duplicating machines, linotype, cinema and radio. Just over 50 years ago, you had jet planes and motorways. Network TV came, photocopying, the programmable computer. And 10 years ago, network computers, multimedia, and mobiles. So what about now? How does that fit into the scheme of things? Well, it does it upside down. Transport is gone. We're thinking of being where we are. We talked this afternoon about the virtual office. We talked about, not so much as Sarah Dobbs did, of being isolated at home, but having a connection with where you want to be. But you are more or less planet communications yourself. Now it's all focused on you. But the point is, where is it all going? Should we allow the tech innovation simply to grow in its own way and we just follow around? You know, you chuck the stuff at the population, see what happens next. Why? Well, frankly, because it's easier. Because you don't have to plan, because you don't have to be a nanny state, you don't have to be a social engineer. You just let it out there and away it goes. The cost, however, of that is too great. First of all, financially, just making it all hang out and see what happens next costs too much because you get wastage. And also, as Peter so wisely said, you have an environmental cost because even though you get free transmissions, the system is not free. In fact, it's very, very expensive. The next argument against, you get too much noise. Frankly, too many messages. I used to get up at 6 a.m. Now I get up at 5 a.m. I spend 2.5 hours just clearing the messages, most of which are crap. And thirdly, which is rather surprising, products, as many people this afternoon said, are often too old-fashioned. Because even though you've got all this stuff, the businesses can operate the same way, and very much the broadcasting happens the same old way. I've mentioned the problem with science broadcasting, with the quotation from Nature, and here's the interesting paradox. If you ask yourself, well, people perhaps aren't interested in science. We have a problem with young people, and as I said, Senator, I'm speaking very much as if I'm not here. One of the problems we have is recruiting new staff. We've got half a person in the science unit because we haven't hired anyone apart from her 3 days a week for 11 years. And we've got a free person from Cambridge who came under her own steam and is a slave. And so you might ask yourself, as Nature did, is the stuff we're doing a load of old crap, you know, to be consigned by the market to history? But if you actually look at some of the figures, every survey I've ever seen has put science absolutely in the top rung. And here, and this is called skiting, I'm told, if you look at some of the figures to do with podcasting, I have a few here. If you look at the total radio podcasts, not just Radio National. I'm fascinated to see number one is the New Music Triple J. Number two is Late Night Live with somebody called Adams. Then AM and PM. Then you've got Dr. Carl. Then you've got The Science Show. Then you've got Brisbane Local Radio. Then you've got Chinese on Radio Australia. Isn't that interesting? Then you've got Breakfast, number nine, 10 Life Matters, 11 All in the Mind, and so you go on. So they're the all of radio. If you look at the top ones from Radio National, one Late Night Live. Now, I must say about Dear Philip, I love him. Sweet guy. But he is on 5 nights a week. Anyway, without doing the maths, Late Night Live, Life Matters, Radio National Breakfast, fourth The Science Show, fifth All in the Mind, sixth The Book Show, seventh The Health Report, eighth Philosopher's Zone, 9 Occam's Razor. 5 out of the top 9 are science. I think that's very interesting. I mentioned television, and again, the old-fashioned style. If you watch ABC television, you get a fantastic breakdown on how to run the British Police Service. Sometimes on a Saturday night, you're not listening, please, Senator Conroy. You can start with a cop in the country at 7:30, then you used to have until they ran out of the bill, two bills, now you've only got one, but it's been replaced by another cop. And then you've got some other thing at 10 o'clock, Foyle's Law, so you've got absolutely throughout the night British cops through history. And on Friday night, you've got another lot. On the commercials, you've got American cops. Now, this is the 21st century. With the fantastic innovation as a result of all the new technologies and how people can use small devices to film their own stuff and edit it on laptops. What are we looking at? Even on the net, we're looking at old-fashioned stuff. So what do we do about that? journalism isn't quite over, but there are some answers. As I said, do not kill off good parts of the old system. There are marvelous people doing good things. There's good technologies. Keep them. Build on those with innovations. Second, experiment. See what works. Do very clever, mean things, and I'll give you some examples in a minute. Third, augment your value. Fourth, please hire kids. Give young people a chance. First, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. They're cheap, apart from anything else. As I say, one or two of them are free. It's interesting that the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, going back a couple, told me last year that the one thing he finds very, very difficult these days is simply to get young people who can write. They can do thousands of things with little machines, but writing a sentence, a paragraph, building a story. Okay, some examples of some of the experiments which might illustrate, they're not just ABC ones, really, they're kind of broader than that. Ways in which we are trying to find out what the internet and other technologies can do. I've run two, and it's going to be soon three, experiments on the Science Show of science that isn't quite ready yet. The first one was about the apparatus on motorways and other roads, the electronic stuff that might be distracting you from driving. Is there evidence? Well, actually, there is some evidence at Swinburne here in Melbourne especially. But we didn't know what that was. We wanted to find out. And so we did the beginnings of a report for the Science Show. And then I went on John Fain's program. I went on Metros in Sydney. We did Australia talks. We went online with various questions. We're doing television. So what we're doing is not simply one report, but multiply. So you can have 1 minute bits. You can have 1 hour bits. And if you go online, you can have very long bits. You are making the most of the effort you're taking, and you're also putting the question out there to find how much people really know about the subject, and you're responding to it both as anecdote and experts. This is not simply chatter. It's genuine research. The second program we did was on internet addiction, so I was fascinated this afternoon to hear about games. There is no question that there is something that they call internet addiction. Whether it's actually a problem, Ian Hickey says it's not a syndrome, it's an aspect of something else. Ian Hickey, the professor of psychiatry, and the person who runs concerns about depression and so forth. Other people think it's genuinely a problem, and in China they've got boot camps where they actually put people through the most horrendous training, and they suggest that 85% of juvenile delinquency is as a result of people being obsessed, young people being obsessed with internet games. We wanted to find out whether this was so. And again, we did a whole program. And then we went on John Fain's and metro stations and Triple J, everywhere, to find out, to experiment, to see how much we could learn from going online at the internet. The final program I'm going to do this year is in 3 weeks. And the question is simply this: what can we do with coal other than burn it? Could it be the basis of a major industry? We've done some interviews already, not least at La Trobe University here in Melbourne. I think it's a very interesting question. Put it out there. Find out what's going on. Don't simply do the old-fashioned thing and bung out a report and saying this is the given word, but see if you can get some sort of reaction. And needless to say, for this, you need young people who can then find out what the reaction is. Which brings me to a second example, which is Project Babelfish, where I failed. I suggested that what we do with this, we've got 40 years of archive in the ABC Science Unit, and I've been talking to the BBC and to Scientific American and National Public Radio and the people in New Zealand, anyone who listens actually, about their archives. And I said, what if we did a 1 hour special on anything you want to know? The internet in China, AIDS, coal. Because we've got everybody. I've even got Florence Nightingale talking in 1890. And if we don't have Aristotle, we've got someone pretending to be Aristotle. And we can put together a 1 hour special, which we would get students to put together, because they'd be slaves, they'd be part of their course teaching them journalism. They'd bring the new technology, we'd tell them the line to take and see whether they produced a good thing. And then we'd have an internet series of items that I hope would be interesting around the world. And as a result of that exercise, the world would know, not least, about Australian science. Now, this isn't a pitch, Senator Conroy, because we mentioned this to Brendan Nelson, and he said, I'll fund that. And too much time passed. I'm not blaming anybody. But his successor then was the decision maker, and she said no. I suspect she didn't even see the proposal. So I've almost given up on that. But I think it would be a tremendous idea, because it would link us. Linkage to other institutions, I think, is absolutely vital. The third example I'll give, again, of the way kids can be involved, was on television last night. My dear, delightful friend Andrew Denton stopped being on television interviewing stars and said, let's find the kids. You know, the big beast that was on last night? Find 19 out of a couple of hundred. See what they want to do. That is the essence of getting people involved. And when all the old fogies, like possibly some of them were on this stage in the second round table, say, well, maybe we don't quite know what's going to happen next, you ask the kids, what are you interested in? They're in the room. They're affecting your culture. They're changing you. And also they're learning from what people like us have got in the way of experience. And you put them together and you get a fantastic synergy. So, my summary, the traditional media are clearly collapsing. The public media are trying in some ways to be all things to all people and don't have too many of the young brains, and they need them. ICT industry is fragmented and confused. The kids in many ways are lost, and the courses are dropping and losing their numbers. However, this could be the biggest revolution since Gutenberg. We have never needed so much good information as Peter has suggested. There are lots of ways in which things can change. I'll finish with a quotation, as I began, from News About the Internet in the New York Review of Books. After that stuff about, in short, the parasite is slowly killing the host. However, Michael Massing, who wrote the article, says, this image of the internet as a parasite has some foundation. Without the vital news gathering performed by established institutions, many websites would sputter and die. In their sweep and scorn, however, such statements seem as outdated as they are defensive. Over the past few months alone, a remarkable amount of original, exciting, creative, if also chaotic and maddening, material has appeared on the internet. The practice of journalism, far from being leached by the web, is being reinvented there with a variety of fascinating experiments in the gathering, presentation, and delivery of news. And unless the editors and executives of our top papers begin to take note, they will hasten their own demise. And finally, from John Birmingham, again in the Monthly, published yesterday, his final paragraph, I'm not sure I quite understand it, but I'll have a go. What has gone forever is the mogul's domineering control of the means of communication and a power that echoed, however dimly, that of the medieval church before Gutenberg printed his first Bible. And my own comment, I wonder what Sol Trujillo would say to that. Thank you very much indeed.